Kia ora and evening, everybody. Good evening. This is the Enemy Sessions Resumed. It's number 9. Today is November the 30th, 2011 in the Northern Hemisphere, and it's December the 1st, 2011 in New Zealand. Today we're back at Inscriptorium, starting in June, with Did Gutenberg Help to Wed the Establishment and the Gospel? Question mark. So this post is June 8th, 2011. What we're going to do is we're going to go through each of these posts and talk to them. It'll be interesting to see how long we survive and whether we find anything of interest. Bob, have you read through this one yet?
No. So here it is. It says, in the semi-annual journal Alphabet, number 13, June 1967, there are a few pages tucked inside. One of them is folded in half, and below I've transcribed the writing. You know, I've never heard of this journal called Alphabet. So anyways, McLuhan subscribed to it or had a copy, right? So this is his commentary on something in that journal. Andrew McLuhan says, it is in pencil, except for one paragraph at the end of page B, starting the age of electric. That's in quotes, the age of electric, which is in black ink. Page D is blank. Okay, A. So these are comments. So A, one of them is falling below at the end of page B. So we go back to page A? Is that what he's saying, that page A is the first commentary by McLuhan?
Yeah, presumably. And page A is the blow-up, the image that you click on the right, it blows up.
Oh, yeah,
you
right.
You can see the actual handwriting there.
So McLuhan says, why not say, we are on the edge of a great religious renaissance? Which, you know, he was saying in that year in an interview, in a dialogue with Malcolm Muggeridge and Norman Mailer in 1968, layout. I can't remember what show it was for, but it was transcribed in Paul Krasner's The Realist. That's where I saw it. We are on the edge of a great religious renaissance. But what I remember is that he says that we're at a great religious time, and somebody, Malcolm Muggeridge, says, what do you mean by great? Do you mean in numbers? And he goes, yes. It was interesting. McLuhan said, numerically it was great, meaning it involved the most people. Didn't necessarily mean great qualitative. He meant great quantitative. At least that's how he responded to Mailer or Muggeridge. Then he says, a natural reversal after centuries of materialism, i.e. consumer utopias, i.e. visual values of superficial non-involvement. We know that's McLuhan dogma. We know what that means. The image of materialism never stronger than in the mirror of the new environment, electric age of information. So he's saying there is an obsolescence in materialism. It's rampant. And that's going to disgust a lot of people, I think, right? It's so obviously the supernova of materialism or visual values. Then he says, satellites equal superhuman environment around planet. Superhuman would be super angelic, because at the end of page today, he said, some people see this new situation as superhuman. He has that in quotes, right? But I think he would tend to call it super angel. So superhuman environment around planet equals end of nature, end of outer world inclines of people to inner trip and mediation. He may mean meditation. It'd be more interesting if he means mediation, because that's a later word popular in the 80s. So end of nature, nature quotes, end of outer world inclines of people, end of outer world inclines of people to inner trip and mediation. Hmm. In management, there's more acceptance of mediation or encounter group kind of psychology. Might be one way to look at it. The group encounter is more acceptable. You know about that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So then B, superhuman environment of info or information equals planet as teaching machine calls for supernatural programming. Now, what's interesting about this to me, I've never seen him talk about superhuman, supernatural so much as right here. You only see passing once or two places, he might say, but he's actually developing this jargon and thinking about it, right?
Yeah, I just ran a search on the superhuman, and it's something that he uses in the 40s. I guess it's when he's been engaging with Nietzsche and what have you, but there's the letter to Peter Bruckner on the 23rd of February 1971, and so he's where he's talking about prayer, and McLuhan says, "Prayer is a form of dialogue between God and his creatures which maintains the real human community within the superhuman orbit. Personally, I can think of no other basis for existence." There's a couple of other places that where he's starting to use it around these late 60s, early 70s period.
Yeah, I see a sentence coming up. This is very interesting for me. "The superhuman environment of information, planet as teach machine, causes supernatural programming, colon, invites us to recall an earlier satellite that announced the reprogramming of nature." He's calling the star of Bethlehem, the star of Beth, as an earlier satellite. Very interesting. And that always evokes, he says in McLean's magazine, December 67, an article about Christmas. He says, "Maybe the star of Bethlehem we will see in the future will be man-made." So isn't that interesting? That's the first time there's actually stuff in this paragraph that I've never seen him develop, but I've seen him just in passing. Like the next word, the incarnation, as a new medium conveyed a new message. In 1983, when I met Nelson Thal, as he got curious about me, he said, and he knew I sort of knew a lot about McLuhan, one day he just said, "Okay, Bob, what does the medium as the message mean?" And I said something like, "The medium as the message means the incarnation, blah, blah, blah." And I said, I used the word the incarnation, and he was floored by that. He'd never heard anybody bring that in. And this is the first time I've ever seen him use it the way I was using it. So this is a confirmation of what I intuited one must say when you talk about the medium message. So he's saying the incarnation as a new medium conveyed a new message. See, the incarnation is a new medium. What's that? Is that the electric second coming?
Yeah, I'll ponder that. But like, he's riffing around themes. Like, I've got another one here, like Marshall McLuhan, where he's interviewed on Christian Frontiers, Technical Revolution in the Church, and this is in February 1965. And he's talking about Telstar, the Telstar satellite, and he's saying that Telstar is the new star up there, but we need a new magi, some wise guys, to go and deal with that new situation.
That means an elite to give the bigger, a more up-to-date big picture, the big data. That
yeah, says, the equivalent of the new Chaldeans, I guess.
Yeah, the new Chaldeans, you mean? Chaldeans? Yeah. Because they were the magi for the Babylonians, is that what you mean?
Presumably, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So he's saying someone needs to be able to define or to pretend to know what's going on. And I see that that never got satisfied. McLuhan never was given the opportunity. And I always said that I was doing that in Secret Council 10 in the 80s and 90s, providing the big picture. And I always say that Croker created a very useful language, but it was just too avant-garde for people. So generally, I had to fall back on avant-garde McLuhanism. But here's McLuhan. He's stating exactly what I knew were the issues. It's quite a, you know how he says in Take Today, the merger of art, science, and nature through understanding media, you know, is the way to program the planet. This is, he leaves out the religious, the supernatural, in that sentence on page, maybe that's, in the middle of Take Today. This is where you bring in the merge of art, science, and nature. You bring in this, what he's saying in these notes. What is he saying? This is he saying this in a journal on the alphabet. Now, one thing about the alphabet is the key to Christianity. It's interesting that he's putting these very esoteric statements in the alphabet journal. It's the right place to do it.
Well, he's commenting on the alphabet. It's not like one of his papers. He's commenting on what somebody else has written.
Right, but it's the right. It's the journal with the right a topic where he could. The alphabet is divine almost, and he's updating for the alphabet audience how they should really look at what's going on, which we know they weren't. It's just it's the right context to put these kind of notes because I've never seen these notes ever anywhere else.
No.
These kind of themes. Have you read this before I did?
No. I'm just coming at it fresh now.
Okay. So the age of electric or all info at once is the age of the breakthrough of depth involvement. It retribalizes man in the image of the family. C, old areas new to the backward. The electric environment spells power, just as the old civilized environment of visual detachment specialism spelled weakness and alienation. So he's talking about the rise of third world imagery, the native aboriginal images, you know, dancing with the wolves, appears to have power, right? Because they're audio tactile, and they resonate with the superhuman electric extension. Old areas new to the backward. I'm not sure if that makes sense in way to the backward. The to the backward, the electric environment spells power. Yeah, yeah. The electric, yeah. They're able to temporarily, in the later phase of the analog media, before you get to 1974 and the post-tactile environment, when you still have the tactile, just like the Germans and Japanese and Italians felt powerful in the 30s, the third world cultures begin to feel powerful. The backward, even the fourth world cultures think that they are, they got a handle on what's happening. They don't, but they feel power. Visual people appear anemic. Okay?
Yeah.
Oh. In our own cities, we see new, this process of power for the weak in the behavior of children. It is the established and it feels helpless. Yeah, the children seem to be king. It's that looking for pre-visual values in pre-visual sensory dynamics, because the post-visual is the ground. So people are rear-view mirror retrieving pre-visual, pre-civilized figures that become archetypally resonant. So then he says the clash between press coverage of Vietnam and TV. Remember what he said, Watergate was a battle between the newspaper and TV over the advertising dollar. So the newspaper is press coverage and television. The hot media leaves us uninvolved. Literacy leaves the Negro cold, not cool. He develops that in the War and Peace book.
Yeah. I'm just wondering how much of that is actually a function of his in-class experience. Like, you know, how he did the whole history of education. He came through Cambridge. He would have been lectured at, and I get the sense that the old lecturers, the old dons, they didn't give a damn whether you got what they were trying to share. They just hammered it out. But presumably in the late 60s, there was a real sense of, generational breakdown. People reached out and tried and thought, well, how do we actually relate ourselves to the new generation, the new young kids? There was a new kind of caring.
That's the cool involvement. The detached mechanical professors, Don's value, the detached, non-involved stance.
Yeah, or establishment feeling helpless. There was a real sense, possibly, of feeling out of touch for the first time and actually thinking that that's problematic as opposed to just forging ahead.
Right. No, when the time Jimmy Carter becomes president in 77, McClune's commenting on the casualness that's taken over the old mechanical industrial establishment. They're starting to wear shirts without ties. They loosen up a bit. You know, the electric massage is loosening up and starting to wear sideburns and mustaches, an attempt to look involved or to actually start to appear tribal and not imposing your detached mechanical point of view and everything. You have to pretend that you're interested in listening to the tribe.
Yeah, yeah. What I always find interesting as I come to McClune is he's careful to say feels helpless, not is helpless, in the same way that you find in people that are less precise in their writing.
That's right. The less precise people they think it's a revolution. That they're helpless. They think their helplessness is helping them, that they're getting intuitive or tuning in, and they don't know what's making them value helplessness.
Yeah.
He has in the preface to maybe the paperback version of Culture is Our Business, he says, our strength is our weakness, and our weakness is our strength. Now, you got to figure out what is our strength, and you have to realize whether you want to be detached or super involved. So the McClune valued separateness. He actually was able to retrieve the mechanical detachment in a new way. But the guys who didn't know the roots of the formal roots of former causality of mechanical detachment didn't know how to prop it up or retrieve it. He did, but it was disguised by him as involvement. Or at least he knew how to put on the new feelings, the new feelings of involvement, the new feelings of the participation mystique. You get a guy like Nixon running for president in 68 on the new participatory involvement. Like, imagine this old fragmented mechanical lawyer trying to be cool. You know, it's ridiculous. But he thought if he said the right words, he'd appear cool. It's very mediocre Big Brother. It's feeble Big Brother programming.
Yeah, well, the billiard ball approach to cool. In the sense of push button A, you get response B, or that's the orientation.
Yeah, they were so used to the establishment, the mafia-ridden establishment, so used to ignoring the people in the 30s and 40s that when they had to sort of show up and meet with the screaming mobs, just the fact that they listened, not that they would have to take any value out of what you're saying, but the fact that they listened, they thought that was cool enough. Just to show up and acknowledge the mob, you know? Now, it's very interesting. He said, literacy leaves the Negro cold, not cool. Now, did you understand that, why the Negro was cold?
Was cold.
This is a test question. This is a test question. the Negro is cool in the television environment in rock and roll and all that. He's got the right resonance, and the black visage looks better than the anemic white face. But the Negro is cold because he is essentially visual and industrial because he grows up in visual space. So he's actually in a paralyzed position. He's visualized and moving towards becoming visual. He wants to take over the old new affluence that the factories and education and literacy provides, even though it's totally not going to hold any water, and they actually look charismatic. But it's the East going West and the West going East. Just when the Negro is charismatic in the software world, it, on the chemical body level, is looking for the new factories and industrial suburban comforts. And it's being eroded by the computerized economy. So they're left cold, not cool.
Yeah. No, I'm seeing the formula at work now, because he's just replaying in a slightly different key the earlier statement. Just as the old civic environment of visual detachment and specialism spelt weakness and alienation. So he's being really
precise.
Yeah, but also mechanical. You know, this is a really formulaic haiku-esque response.
Yeah, he's doing tetrad management. He's running the United Nations. He's saying, okay, we got this troubled borderline here and that troubled borderline over there, and here's how we do it. And both sides are inadequate to the occasion, and my perceptions will soothe the tensions. I mean, he's saying, Mike, his patterns will soothe the tensions. You get that?
Yep.
Yeah, so then he says, the poor and humble heard our Lord's cool message gladly. The establishment didn't get it. That's going back to the Council of Trent, you know, 1600s and the Catholic Church and how they became a bureaucracy. Did Gutenberg help to wed the establishment and the gospel? Interesting.
Good question.
Yeah, it's like, what is the establishment? The charm circle of the secret elites that were starting to bring in centralized banking in the 1600s, you know, the... what was that network called? It begins with F. There's one reference to it in Take Today. The Fulberg Gang or the Footberg. Forget that name of the first newsletter. It just doesn't come to me right now. It begins with F. It was Turner Taxis and his family, which brought in the postal system. They started circulating an insider intelligence newsletter. And just can't remember what it is. And it's mentioned once, I think, in Take Today. The Fugger newsletter, that's what it was. I think it was the Fugger newsletter. So is that the establishment he's talking about way back in 1600? I think so. The poor and humble heard our Lord's message cool. You know, they were not literate. They heard the cool message. Glad the establishment didn't get it. So he's talking about 400 years ago. Did it help the... Yes. Okay, so now he's talking about the establishment before, the medieval establishment. They never got it, maybe, because they were tending toward visuality from the time of Charlemagne on, and the people always got it on the cool feudal era. But then Gutenberg takes that establishment and weds it and makes it acceptable, because the hierarchy that was happening in the Dark Ages period could be acceptable once you had the printing press effect. And that is what loses, and that's not charismatic in the electric age. That's one way I look at this.
Yeah, it's
absolutely. If you look at the establishment as visual bias, it wasn't until Gutenberg that the establishment could justify its bureaucratization.
Yep. It's... Though in this context, establishment is left. It's an open term. We can fill it in any way we want.
Yeah, it could even be the prince of the air establishment.
Yeah, it's. I guess it's a, in one some ways it's an update and replay of an old theme. I mean, early on, McLuhan talks about Christianity as being essentially an Eastern religion, and being completely antithetical to the Western Latin Roman enterprise, and so
the visual bureaucracy.
So that's the great mystery: is how did how and why, and is there questions of providence related to how the empire took on Christianity, which was essentially Eastern.
Right, Constantine tried it, but they once the papyrus is gone, it fell apart, and you went into the Dark Ages, which was maybe an actual more amenable to the oral basis of Christianity. But then the printing press comes in, or the visualization leading up to the printing press, the gospel is printed, and the bureaucratic empire can ride with that effect because it's bureaucratic. So. It's only when the printing... Gutenberg definitely is the only reason the establishment could adopt the gospel.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, one that I don't think anybody's really taken on in any depth.
Until we're the first. De Kerckhoff touches on it very slightly in the 1982 period when he raises the point that Marshall used to question him and say, you know, is it providential that Jesus embedded his message in the alphabet?
Yeah.
Because he knew that visual space would, in the long run, take over. And that's all I've ever seen on it, right? And what we just did is the closest anybody's ever done, unless he did it with a couple of the priests privately.
Yeah, there was some. It's expanded slightly in the medium, the light. A couple of those later essays there, but as questions brought up. But I've never seen questions mined. That said, there's a couple of dissertations that have come out of the Vatican recently that I think might address that question, but I don't know yet.
I mean, people who know McLuhan are just catching up.
Well, catching up, but I don't know.
What we just did has never been heard before.
Yeah, I'm happy with that, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, we're capable to... No, if we met some of these priests or whoever are concerned about these issues, if they encounter me, I'd be able to talk to them about it.
Yeah.
More than we've done today. Anyways, there's rich stuff there. I just want to look at what Mark Stallman says. I like how it ends. Thanks for reading, Andrew. It could be addressing you. Thanks for reading, Andrew. Crystal?
Yeah, no. my pleasure, Andrew McLuhan.
So what does Mark say? Andrew, this is a very powerful statement and an important find. Yeah, because he's very interested in the dynamics of Christianity, Mark is. Perhaps you have seen the last words of Take Today, Finnegan and Resurrection. Now, I always find it cute that Mark... It starts quoting Finnegan's Wake references. He knows nothing but the Wake. He doesn't know how to tackle it. So let's see if he even gets back into it. You know, there's a definite... You need to know Finnegan's Wake well and understand Eric's thesis to understand what's going on here when McLuhan ends Take Today, Finnegan and Resurrection.
Yeah.
Mark Stallman says, what was important to him wasn't just the incarnation, but also the resurrection. Well, this is not necessarily the case because Barry Nevitt did a lot of Take the Day, and this may have been Nevitt. But then others would say, well, no line would get in there without Marshall checking it. So we'll give it that, yes, Marshall saw this, and it's him accepting what Barry put in. Because Barry used this phrase a lot in his 80s articles. He would come back to this theme. So, as you know, your father, Eric, often talks about our being in a renaissance today. Now, we covered that, the quantitative level. You got to know what he said to Malcolm Muggeridge, that it was quantitative renaissance. I don't know if it means the way Eric means it. Okay, as you know, your father, Eric, often talks about being in a renaissance today, which he believes is part of a 400-year cyclical pattern, which I interviewed him about at the recent McLuhan Initiative Seminar. That would be in Winnipeg back in May or something, right?
Yep.
Your grandfather also mentions multiple renaissances in his PhD thesis. I think he only mentions two, the time of Petrarch, which is the invisible, unknown renaissance, 1200, the suppressed one, and then there's the renaissance of the Gutenberg era, unless he means there was a renaissance at the time of Augustine or something. What would you say? There's two mentioned? Is there three or four mentioned in... you know what I mean? I don't know if there's more than two. What would you say?
In
the PhD thesis, isn't there only two mentioned?
I know there's 800, so what's that? 800 is Charlemagne, and then there'll be 1,200. Although there's a lesser one. I think the 400-year cycle thing does come out of the thesis. It's not a rigid 400 years.
McLuhan does not, I don't think, lay out the 400-year cycle. Eric makes that explicit, you know, 20 or 30 years later. McLuhan may have been aware of it, thinking of it.
And if you look at the flash points or the key transition points in that thesis, they roughly coincide with a 400-year cycle.
No, I agree, but that is not said.
No, it's not made explicit by any stretch of the imagination.
Right, but so that would mean a renaissance at the time of Jesus, one at the time of Augustine, one at the time of Charlemagne, the one at Petrarch, and then one in the Elizabethan age, all right? And then there's a new one happening in the 20th century, which he doesn't go into, but it's implied by the last line of the thesis about what Joyce discovered.
Yeah.
Okay, but it is not talked about too much. I don't think.
No, I'm just running a search right now.
Okay, well, I'll continue while you're doing it. The publication where HMM contributed the most, even more than in explorations, is called Renaissance. It was started by the Catholic Renaissance Society and was edited by John Pick, who was McLuhan's godfather at his 1937 conversion. I don't think Mark is aware of how McLuhan mocks John Pick. Have I told you that story? I think I have. He used to say, I knew a man who tried to organize the whole system of the history of English literature, and he did such a good job, he became the system. And McLuhan was mocking John Pick. And I see that if Pick was still editor of Renaissance and did that in the 60s, I don't know when Pick stopped or what happened to him. I see that's McLuhan 1962, where he's dropping his involvement with Renaissance because John Pick and them can't get the new message. And that's why he starts joking about John Pick. So he may have been godfather, you know, an important figure, a mentor or whatever in the 30s and 40s. McLuhan moves, he's not too interested in Pick in the 60s and makes fun of him.
Yeah, it's those Renaissance articles are good in a certain sense. You can also reposition them in terms of what McLuhan said to Kenner, you know, where he's talking about that he's gone so far that he can only essentially write the old stuff. You know, like he's almost crossed the threshold of intelligibility. And so,
when does he say that to Kenner? Are you talking about 49?
I think it's 51.
Okay, yes, because he drops that. Even Peter McCormick tells a story of, as a student at 62, he said, Marshall, he could tell whatever involvement he had in McLuhan. He said, McLuhan lost interest in the literary critical enterprise around 62. I mean, that's because you're moving into satellite global theater, and Marshall's not even going to be identified with the TV culture. It's moving into the discarnate, angelic, computerized world. The The point is that those articles are very important to understand the underpinnings of the early McLuhan. But if you go to page, I think, 468 of the letters, where he says, he raises the question that these issues, nobody in the Catholic world is recognizing that we have a bigger challenge here of the electronic superangelization. Have you ever looked at that letter? I pointed out, and you were supposed to post that in the media calls you list. Did you ever look at the middle of that letter?
I haven't gone back to it.
Do you have the letters right
now?
Yeah,
I can grab it right now. Just give me one second.
Yeah, go to page 468, and it's the middle of the page. He raises the question that I think that Mark Stallman doesn't deal with. But while you're doing that, so he says...
Yeah, I've got it now.
Okay.
So 468.
Above the middle.
In the middle of the page?
Yeah, so go a line or two above the middle and work towards the question in the very middle of that letter, of the page.
I'll start reading here. Every technological change or innovation brings in new political forms and new dogmas that are mustered to fend off the new threats. Is not the history of dogma the story of the wall built against the world? As Chesterton said, any stigma is good enough to beat a dogma. I have no doubt at all that Christus Vinci, this is my terrible Latin coming through again, that is why a Christian cannot be amused at the antics of worldlings to put us on. This, however, does not resolve the question of what kinds of strategies literate people should deploy in propping up this or that... what is it? ...portion of worldly culture at any given time. Is that what you...
I think that's the statement. Now read the next sentence, just in case maybe there's more.
Must not the Christian strategy be pragmatic and tentative?
Exactly. Then what's the next sentence?
When the entire Western world is going inward via electric information and the entire Orient is going outward via Western hardware and technology, how is it possible to make value judgments? We already know the qualities and satisfactions to be attained by both these modes of the visual and acoustic. Shall we simply say a plague on both your houses? I mean both your city house and your country house. This is from to Sheila Watson, isn't it? I remember this letter. Barbara Ward, this is he's written the same thing to Sheila Watson elsewhere.
But this is to Barbara Ward.
Yep. We can't take either of these houses very seriously. At present, when the power to create diverse forms of space and work and residence are almost unlimited, it would seem to be a very good time to update the vision of a Christian culture or city.
Yeah, I think you're past the center. I remember there was a question mark right in the middle of the page, and I think you said the sentence with the question mark, and you can go back and say it. See, that is... the deepest points he's making. And that is a he doesn't think anybody gets the issues there. Would you agree with me?
Yeah.
And I don't see Mark Stallman addressing that. Marshall's being gutsy enough to say, we may not, the stock of responses, the huge repository responses, are not adequate to this new situation.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually in this, any stigma is good enough to beat a dogma. Essentially,
right.
it's anti, you know, Pharisaic. It's quite a radical statement to make.
Yeah, so that's what I think Tom Farrell or anybody else on the media calls you with should be pointing to Mark. That just quote that section and see how he handles that. Because he's saying that, hey, you guys haven't even begun to figure out how the hell can we be a Christian?
No, I don't think that's quite what he's saying, Bob, at all, actually. I think he's saying, from his own position, possibly from his own Christianity, is, yep, I'm in dialogue, I'm in relationship, I have things, I'm in right order, possibly that's one way to say it, yet... these artifacts, these printed laws, these modes of thinking, older modes, do not appear to immediately relate to my situation.
Including the old oral culture or medieval bias.
Yeah, yeah.
He's talking from the tactile position, that tactility. How are we going to deal with the sensory tactility? And it's 10 years later, the more advanced McLuhan, who recognizes even a post-tactile.
Yeah, or that, I guess a simple way is both the written and spoken words are out of date with our situation, which would be the dogma.
Right.
So that's the old poetic question.
Yeah, and you can take his essays in the early 50s on the two Manichaean societies, the vertical symbolists and the horizontal symbolists, and you could say that's the two houses he's talking about. That's what Mark would say, the two versions of Gnosticism. No, Marx was including the Catholic, visual, traditional, whatever Mark calls it. That tradition, it falls short. Not just the Gnostic division, both the East and the West. The East doesn't have the ability to respond to this at all.
Yeah, and so I think he's quite specific in terms of where he's talking about his project in the late 60s and 70s, where he is teaching the churchmen how to update their language. And that's...
Yeah.
Or update their perception, which is part and parcel of that endeavor.
And what's the date of that letter?
The... this one right here? This This is February 9, 1973.
Okay, that's him... he might say something like that in the mid-60s to a priest or two, right? Some obscure letter, he'll throw the question at them. He says it in an article in 1954, but he starts to get more blatant about it in the 70s, and that's probably what the Babin, what are the lectures in the Electric Light, the dialogues, who is it with?
Yeah, Pierre Babin, yep.
Yeah, that's where I have not read them in many years. Does he get this far as this letter does in those dialogues?
Yes, there's quite a number of letters that are in some ways this is more pointed. He's a lot softer when he's speaking.
Yes, I think this is important. This is the most pointed he gets.
Yeah, well, I don't know that you can get any more pointed, you know.
Yeah.
In some respects, this is, yeah.
He might not. It's interesting. Barbara Ward, she became a heavy New Age figure. I think she did. There's a Barbara, someone who speaks to the whole Aquarian conspiracy gang for decades. I'm starting to get an echo. So is that just cyclical, or have you changed the mic there?
No. Is it still echoing? I think we should still be okay.
Okay? No, it's still there, but hopefully it'll go away. It's like maybe it's partly the distance you do. Remember, it's something to do with your positioning.
Yeah, it's when I get too close to the screen.
Right. So, no echo now. Barbara Ward, what did they say about below? Is she an economist or something?
No footnote.
Well, you have to go to an earlier letter then. But anyways...
I lied. Barbara Ward has been foreign editor of The Economist, governor of the BBC, and was, at this time, completing a period of teaching at Columbia University in the School of International Affairs.
I don't think it's the Barbara that I'm thinking of. Okay, let's assume it isn't. But anyways, it's very interesting that he says this to a woman, you know, and who's probably a Protestant. He wouldn't talk these issues, Barry Nevitt would say, to a non-Catholic, but for some reason he's saying it to a non-Catholic, or unless she is a Catholic, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know that they are specifically Catholic concerns, and I think in later life he was not...
He's addressing all of Christianity.
Yeah. I mean, Alan Maruyama, who was the Presbyterian minister that actually did his PhD on McLuhan in the late 70s. I think McLuhan talked and corresponded with him as openly as anybody.
Yeah. And he is a what?
Well, I tried to follow that up. Like, I think he was he disappears and goes off the map, and I think he turns up back as a massage therapist, like later on.
What is he at the time he's being written to by McLuhan? Just a PhD student?
Yeah, PhD student and Presbyterian minister.
Oh, he's a minister. Okay, so Marshall addresses religious issues to him. Okay.
Yep.
So Mark goes on. Marshall contributed 36 articles/reviews and at least 2 speeches to the Renaissance Society, and was on the editorial board from 54 to 62. Unfortunately for McLuhan's scholarship, this material is almost completely unknown. Well, Arthur Croker, at least becomes a bit aware of it because he knows about the article Catholic Humanism, which in Modern Letters, which is addressed to the Renaissance Society, I think, in 54. And that may be enough, what Croker addresses. To go into the details, you have to be interested in a lot of literary issues about Eliot. He's working on a lot of relationships between Eliot and Pound and Lewis and Joyce. And I don't even know if Mark is interested enough in that modernist literature to appreciate those articles. But it's not significant to say that he's talking to an insider Catholic group. He may be in the 50s, but he's not doing that in the 60s. And by the time that this Barbara Ward letter, he's addressing all factions.